Nutmeg, if you have 2 tablespoons, becomes a hallucinogen, and it's highly toxic.
Wait, what? That'd be aggressive.
Well, I'm gonna try that one. Let's test that myth
nutmeg.
Out.
Nutmeg.
I like where this is going. So, is this true or is this just like?
Who are the Mythfits? Carrie Byron, Tori Belleci. Together more than 20 years having fun together.
Hey there, Mythfits. We are back. It's another Mythfits Monday. And I gotta say, do I look as jet lagged as I feel? I'm just coming back from New York, so I feel I feel like I might look a little crazy.
I mean, you're asking the wrong person.
No, I'm actually, this is your cue to say, no, Carrie, you look amazing.
You look fabulous, Carrie. Oh my gosh, you look like you just got back from holiday. What were you doing in New York, I wonder? I'm sure you're going to tell me.
So when Mythbusters started, like, my dream was obviously not to be on TV. I got the job with Jamie Hyneman because I wanted to do like what you were doing. I wanted to do special effects. I wanted to do toy prototyping. And I loved toy prototyping. I loved sitting there and doing sculpture. And, you know, Jamie hired me to like learn how to do that. And I was working on things like the Leapfrog Library toys, and they were all educational toys. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world that I carve this handle or I carve this little star, and then the exact thing that I was carving ends up in the mold that they send to China, because this was before 3D printing. So like, even if something was just like a little organically kind of off, that was going to end up in the final. And I just remember going into, I think it was Target, and seeing the Leapfrog Library on the shelf and just like, oh my God, that is my carving. That is my sculpture. And just that tangible thing was so cool. So one of the things I was doing in New York is I'm going on a little adventure to learn how to make toys. And so I was meeting with somebody who is in the toy business, and I'm showing him something that I want to make. And I will be documenting this whole thing later, but I'm just kind of in the preliminary part of figuring out how to become a
Carrie
toy maker.
The toy maker.
But well, the coolest part was like, I was in New York. So like, I got to go eat out at restaurants that I'm unfamiliar with, because I've eaten out in San Francisco so much that I got to go to like, I went to this Italian restaurant. I was thinking of you because I was sitting there. It felt like I was in an episode of The Bear. I'm watching this well-oiled machine of just like a super hopping restaurant happen, and wine and food and everything happening, but like also just kind of being an observer, watching people on dates and having conversations. And it just, I don't know, it was really fun.
How cool. That sounds fun. I love New York. New York's the best, especially the nightlife, just the bar scenes, the clubs. It's just, I don't know, I love it.
That's what I really love about like the humanity of New York, is like, you've got the restaurants and the theater and all, you know, it's just all of these really visceral experiences. I think it's one of those things that it's just, you can relate to other people really well with these kind of experiences, which is why I'm kind of excited about what we're talking about today. We're going to be talking to somebody called Chef Fatty. He's an influencer on Instagram that I personally have been getting really into cooking lately. So my feed is just filled with like chefs and recipes and that kind of thing. And I half the time don't know what I'm doing. I'm excited to talk to another chef about like some of the tips that he's put out online. I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea. This is why my chicken always tastes like, you know, dry rubbery stuff. Like I'm learning tips on how to not make it taste like that. And he's definitely been somebody who's been of interest to me in my feeds.
Yeah, you turned me onto him. I mean, I guess you found him online, and I started watching all his stuff. All his stuff is great because it's so practical. I love his videos because he takes all these kind of different hacks to make food taste better, for vegetables to last longer. So if you love to cook, you're going to love this episode.
It's not just cooking. He does the science of cooking. It's very Mythbustery, because I know we did a lot of food episodes on the show itself. And in fact, we did so many food myths. I think even season one There was, we did Biscuit Bullet, because I remember the popping happening when I was actually, I think I was still like trying to work on that toy dream next door in Jamie's shop. Do you remember this one?
Yeah. So if you guys don't remember, the story was a woman was driving home from shopping and it was like a hot day in her car. All of a sudden she heard a pop. She felt something hit the back of her head and she went to grab it and she felt her brains falling out of her head. And
her brains are falling out of her head and she's calling. She's like, my brains have just shot out of my head. I've been shot in the head. And she
right. But it's like, if you think about when we tested this myth, cell phones weren't that available. Like it's such a crazy story. But anyway, so paramedics, somebody saw her pull over to the side of the road and was holding the back of the head and they called the paramedics. They show up and she's like, I'm holding my brains in my skull. And they removed her hand and she was holding cookie dough, like the Pillsbury, like pop. The canned biscuits. Yeah, the canned biscuit dough had overheated. It blew up and shot dough to the back of her head. And she thought she got shot in her head and was losing her brains. That's crazy, dude. That's crazy.
She thought that the bullet didn't hurt and that she was holding on to her brains when she basically just got knocked in the head and there was like goo. They're just goo.
Well, I feel like if you think about those caps, right, the metal caps on the ends of those tubes, if that thing shot hard enough, it would hit the back of your head. You'd be like, dang, something hit me hard. Like, you know, maybe she was just in shock. She thought she had got shot in the head. I don't know.
Yeah. It was confirmed. Like I don't know why this was so early on. Adam was using his own car to test it. Like this was very early, zero budget. They confirmed it. They confirmed that you can, in a hot enough car, or plausible, in a hot enough car that...
To get hit in the back of the head.
Yeah, they couldn't confirm the story because it wasn't one where it was like, we have a report that this actually happened. It was like a friend of a friend of a sister of a cousin or some junk. But like, they did... I guess it would be just plausible that those could explode.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, it wasn't as fun to test as, like, do you remember when we were exploding champagne bottles?
Yeah, that was so much fun.
That was so much more fun. Man, where it was, like, seeing if champagne bottles could open up because, like, all of the champagne was getting too hot. That was way cooler.
The myth was a truck caught on fire. A truck that was transporting bottles of champagne caught on fire, and the heat from the fire started exploding the bottles of champagne. And so all these corks were just like flying out like a machine gun out of the back of the truck container and people were getting hit on the side of the road. And so we went and tested that. And we actually took a retired truck trailer, filled it with tons of cheap champagne, lit it on fire at the bomb range. And it was pretty awesome. I mean, it didn't do exactly what the myth was saying, but it definitely shot like bottles were exploding and corks were going everywhere.
And then we had a ton of cheap champagne, which was, you know, that's always fun. I think champagne bottles are really, really dangerous. I wonder what the statistics are in like the loss of eyes and such from champagne bottles going off in the wrong direction. Because you've seen people like they try to shake up the bottle and like they're standing over it or they're aiming it towards people. Like people just do the dumbest stuff.
We need to do a compilation. Note to editors, can we get a compilation of just champagne opening, bottles of champagne being opened fails? Because it's like, I feel like there's so many. And then there was, did you see that one? It was like this French champagne maker and they had this giant like Jeroboam or, it was like a huge bottle of champagne and they went to saber it and he like, did a couple of takes and it just exploded in his arms. Have you seen this video?
No, I haven't seen that. But I do remember when you and I were on the White Rabbit Project, part of our act was I came out and sabered a champagne bottle. But it was always like we were always trying to source it. And one point they gave us like apple cider instead because I couldn't find the champagne. And I remember there was at least one show where, like, I just couldn't get it to go. And, like, I tried and failed and tried and failed. And then I tried one more time and, like, I just bust the whole bottle with the end of the dull, dull blade that we were using. Do you remember that? Because it wasn't even, because they didn't give me champagne. They gave me like apple cider and the bottle wasn't made the same. And it was just like, oh God, total. How embarrassing. Because I'm like, I'm really good at this. Let me savor this bottle. And it's like, oh, now glass all over the stage. Wait, are you wearing them right now?
Yeah.
I'm not going to make you stand up and turn around.
Don't make me stand up and turn around, Carrie. It's embarrassing.
But you look comfortable. You've been sitting in them for a whole podcast.
I know. When I do podcasts, I put on my perfect jeans because they're so comfy. They don't pinch. I just need to get more pairs because I love them so much.
You have that one pair. You're going to need more. You need a full wardrobe. We're podcasting a lot lately. The perfect jeans are versatile, comfortable, and stylish enough for so many different occasions. You don't have to worry about changing your outfit from what you wear at home to going out or from explosions to podcasts.
The perfect jean has reinforced belt loops, so they don't start pulling away after a season of real use.
The details of what goes into how the perfect jeans are made is what separates a $79.99 pair built to last from a $40 pair that you might replace every 8 months.
Our listeners get 15% off their first order plus free shipping at theperfectjean.nyc. Or Google the perfect jean and use code MythFits15 for 15% off.
You know what I'm doing right now, Tori? I'm ordering you more jeans.
Thank you.
You need another pair of the perfect jeans. Hey, all you MythFits. It is an honor to bring in Chef Charles Kim, otherwise known on my social media channels as Chef Fatty, which, what an amazing name. It's something I don't forget.
Welcome, Charles.
No, thanks so much. It's truly an honor. I'm a little starstruck, I'll be honest. But it's great to connect with you both.
So I guess you watched MythBusters before? You saw our show?
I did. Gosh, where do I begin? I think I spend most of my youth watching Discovery Channel or the Food Channel. And so definitely
awesome.
Watched a lot of MythBusters, watched a lot of Bill Nye. So definitely a heavy influence in sort of my pursuit of food science, if you will.
This is kind of a two-part question. One, how did you get your nickname, Chef Fatty? And two, what are you excited about right now?
If you see baby pictures of me, you would understand, but I love to eat growing.
Feel free to send those forward, and in the final edit, we'll put those up. If we have to contact your mom, we will.
We're going to find those photos.
Oh, you know, I've always loved eating growing up, and there's a when you turn a year old in Korea, there's a cultural sort of event that you do where you put in front of the kid all sorts of different symbols of what you might be when you grow up. So, you know, for a doctor, you get a stethoscope and so on and so forth. And apparently during my little ceremony, I would grab the plate of food from the buffet and not let go. So I think it's destiny.
Yes.
But, you know, I've always loved to eat, and there's not only, you know, have I been called fatty, a fatty for a very long time, but it also came out of the earlier version of our account, because the account used to be called Fatty Sammy's for fat sandwiches when I was trying to promote the bakery. So it was kind of a natural transition for everybody, and it was fun, lighthearted, but it has a little bit of history and a little bit of everything there. In terms of what I'm working on, you know, I was kind of curious, like, why are so many people interested in herbs? And a lot of folks came back and said, well, we're trying to save money. And especially, you know, with grocery prices going up, those are things that I cannot control. But what I can do is I teach these little tricks and tips to help people try to save money at home, become better cooks and budget and so on and so forth. So we're working on a little project called Fridge Buddy. And the idea is, hey, take a picture of the receipts of the things that you bought, take a picture of everything in your fridge, and we'll show you a bunch of things that you can make with it so things don't go bad. We'll also tell you how to store it and notify you when they're about to go bad so you can use it up before you have to throw it out.
That's great.
And the average household in the U.S., I think, spends or wastes about $2,100 worth of groceries a year and throws out about 165 pounds of food a year as well. And so it'll really help people cut back. But the beauty of sort of this model is we also want to do something called buy one, give one, where if you get like a month of subscription, we'll give 3 months of subscription to someone who's on SNAP or EBT benefits, just so that we can help everybody sort of save and be a little smarter about how they're budgeting for food going forward. So we're really excited about it. It's in beta right now. And so, you know, hopefully when we share some of this news, you can sign up to try it out. But Fridge Buddy, getfridgebuddy.com.
So what's your background as far as food science goes? Because obviously we know you're a chef. Where did the science come in for you?
Yeah, so you know, I have a pretty interesting, weird sort of journey to this space. I actually started out as an engineer, and that was actually my my career sort of goal. My father was an engineer. My mom was a teacher. And, you know, if you know much about Asian culture, Asian parents really want you to, you know, become an engineer or a doctor. And so I pursued that. But I've always sort of loved cooking. I spent a lot of time with my mom because my mom had two sons. I was a younger son. And so I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen. So she taught me how to cook. So we spent a lot of time experimenting with different recipes, so on and so forth. But as I was sort of pursuing this career and this education in engineering, after a while, I sort of realized, you know, I really want to go back to my roots. And so long story short, I got my degree from Michigan for operations engineering, spent about 10 years at a tech company called Amazon, working on all sorts of different stuff. But throughout that time, I was sort of in and out of restaurants. I actually started working at a restaurant until I realized I kind of want to go big corporate, so on and so forth. And so that's kind of how I landed here.
How did you transition from being a chef to kind of being this online sensation?
You know, I actually started out with no intent of becoming an online sensation. Maybe, I think most people probably start out that way. My wife opened a bakery a couple of years ago, and we spent a lot of time trying to perfect really great gluten-free breads and desserts. And we were having a hard time really marketing the product. And so she really convinced me and said, look, you should just try posting a couple videos on Instagram of you making sandwiches because you're really good at making sandwiches. And so we did that for a while. And then at one point it started going viral. I remember I was in a meeting with a bunch of, you know, corporate execs in a in this boardroom, and my phone started blowing up. And it turned out I went viral on TikTok for this sandwich that I did of a Nashville, you know, a hot chicken sandwich. And so I'm in this meeting and I'm sort of having this surreal moment of like, is this what I do from now on? And then somebody stopped me at the airport going, hey, are you that, you know, Fatty Sammy's guy? That's what my account used to be called.
Oh my God, dude. I
had a long conversation with my wife and, you know, he said, you know, you should really pursue this. And this was 7 months ago. So it's I haven't been doing this for too long.
Wow.
But after sort of that happened, I you know, kind of went back to everything that I loved growing up, all my influences, and wanted to kind of dive into it, see what happens. So it all started out as an experiment.
So the one that got me is because you were suggested under all of my, I follow a bunch of chefs, and I was trying to make some chicken, and you had something about soaking the chicken first in salty water brine, but also adding a little baking soda because that was going to make the chicken juicy. And I'm like, all right, okay, let's try this. And it actually worked. And you explained both the science behind it and this really cool technique. Are you more like leaning into science forward, technique forward, ingredients forward? Like what kind of surrounds your niche?
So it's really interesting. I would almost characterize my approach as being failure forward. So
hey, you are one of
our style.
So everything that I do kind of like starts off from how did I mess something up and why did it turn out that way? So I actually have a funny story about the velveting one. When I first started out cooking, I worked at a Korean restaurant that adapted a lot of like Chinese techniques. And we use a technique called velveting. And in velveting, you use a little baking soda, you increase the alkalinity, makes the protein absorb moisture or prevent it from releasing moisture, and you add cornstarch to it. And I was a line chef at the time, or line cook at the time. And we, it was a very small restaurant. And one of the guests was like, hey, I need to talk to the cook. And so I was like, okay, well, this is either going to be really good or horrific. And I went up to the customer at his table, and he was, you know, Caucasian male, probably in his 60s, 70s. And he just started cursing me out about how the chicken dish that we were serving at the time just was off, and it was disgusting. And, you know, we've heard pretty much all of it. And so he basically said, like, something was off, it's disgusting, and, you know, kind of went through the dictionary of curse words. And I took it back, and the chef pulled me aside and said, hey, you know, because I was also relatively new to the country at the time. He's like, you know, this is racism. You'll get used to it. Customers are like that. Not a big
ouch.
Deal. I was like, okay, great. But something was a little bit off. And so, you know, I grabbed a spoon and I took a bite out of his plate. I probably shouldn't have done that in retrospect.
Did he take offense to that?
Well, it was in the back, so he didn't, see,
you didn't do it in front of him. That would have been hilarious if you'd done it right in front of him. Here, let me try it.
I would have been fired on the spot. Right. And I realized he was actually right. The chicken was mushy, and it had a little bit of a bitterness to it. And so I started thinking, like, okay, well, the customer isn't always right, but there must be some science behind it. And I started digging into what happens. And what actually happens with alkaline is... it essentially denatures the protein. So it turns it into a very mushy texture. And there are a lot of people who are sensitive to that, to alkaline itself. And for them, it'll taste metallic, especially if it sits out for too long. And that's when I sort of learned about the different ways of tenderizing your meat, the mechanical, the chemical, as well as the moisturizing, so on and so forth. And that's kind of fueled my discovery process as well. So I always start with failure, and I've too many stories about this, both in and out of the kitchen.
So there's one myth that I want to talk to you about, because I saw one of your videos and you kind of break it down. It's MSG. Like, I love MSG. I think it adds so much flavor to food. But growing up, it was like, it's the worst thing for you. Like, it's so bad. It'll give you headaches. It's bad for your heart. I mean, just so much bad press around MSG. What is your take on MSG?
Yeah, it's a hot topic. And I feel like the general population is sort of getting a little more educated on that, but it's still a little bit complicated. So MSG, monosodium glutamate, essentially is a form of umami. Back in the day, you know, they used to make it with fermented fish. Yeah, you know, so fish sauce has a lot of it. These days, they use a bacteria to produce that in a much larger industrial scale. There's been a lot of studies that essentially proves that for large populations, it doesn't really affect you much at all. But what I also find interesting about myths is typically, or food-related myths, is people find these types of anecdotal evidence based off of correlation and not causation. And yeah. So there is some correlation. There's two areas that I think scientists are still trying to study. And so migraine disease and fibromyalgia are two areas where we don't really understand how MSG impacts those symptoms. And so it's hard for me to say at this stage that, yes, it's safe. For the general population, yeah, I think a lot of it is disproven, but there are certain areas or pockets of science where we're still trying to better understand. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that the glutamate part of monosodium glutamate is part of the neurotransmission process. And please let me know if I'm getting too nerdy on this.
Not for our audience. Are you kidding me? You're speaking our language to this audience.
Perfect. And so the glutamates are part of that neurotransmission process. And so they do believe that the MSG is impacting some of that. And so my wife, who suffers or struggles with chronic migraine disease, we do find that MSG is a trigger of migraine attacks, but we're still trying to better understand exactly what's going on there.
So, Chef, what food myth do you feel like you find yourself debunking the most often? Because I'm sure you're faced with a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you should go through my comment section. It's crazy. It's a war zone. The number one myth, I think, that still comes up is the microwave. And it usually falls into two buckets. It's microwaves kill nutrients, which, mm-hmm. you know, science has debunked for a long time. But the second is that chefs don't use microwaves, which I thought was really interesting. And it's still pretty contested. But there's a belief that if you're a real cook or chef, that you should not use a microwave. The reality is, like, we use microwaves all the time. If you go to any like major kitchen, it's just a great way to heat up food, heat up water really fast. So it's really great for melting chocolate. It's great for quickly reheating sauces. I've been working on a lot of recipes just to like, not because I love controversy. I mean, I love a good debate, but people love cooking with microwaves just because it's easy. And so I've actually been working on a lot of new vegetable recipes just focused on it. So one of my favorites that I'm actually going to be posting here soon is the cauliflower steak. So if you have cauliflower and you put it in an air fryer at 400 for, you know, about 20, 30 minutes or so, it's going to turn out perfect. However, if you put it in a microwave, it comes out perfect in 5 minutes. And then you can pan fry, you can do all sorts of stuff with it. But the microwave one constantly comes up as it's not real cooking or it's bad for you. So I'm always fighting those allegations.
Well, I mean, I might be dating myself here, but I remember when I was little and microwaves were a new fancy big kind of thing. My mom took a microwave cooking class in the 80s, and that food was freaking terrible. And I'm just guessing it might have been her chefing skills, but the she made everything in the microwave from bacon to like, but oh my God, you're going to have to convince me that it's just as good. I use it for reheating, but I don't cook in it. So I'm looking forward to this journey because I do have a little of a stigma. I'm like, ooh.
It's good for some things. It's not definitely not good for everything. I think someone once showed me a microwave meatloaf recipe and I said, please don't do that.
No.
So microwaves, as you probably know, is some wave that's hitting it and typically goes into food anywhere between like half an inch to an inch. So if your food is like relatively thin or is under that size and it's full of water, it's going to be amazing. No proteins. I mean, we all know about fish. And so if you just stay within those rules, you should be generally safe.
Well, I love your hack on browning or caramelizing onions. Because I love, you know, caramelizing onions, but it takes forever. And your hack was microwave it first, chop it up, microwave it, and then you can brown it like in 10 or 15 minutes.
You know, I am a little torn about that video because I learned something new after I posted it. I learned that people have different microwaves and not all microwaves are created equal. When I posted that video, I tested it a lot as well with a couple different microwaves, but I got probably about 2 dozen messages saying, "Hey, I did exactly what you told me to, and now my microwave is on fire."
Because
some people's microwaves are just really strong, I guess. And they had
what
proof.
They
showed
the
me the receipt.
Onions in like a tin foil bag. Like, how do you catch on fire?
So I think what they did was because their microwaves are so strong, and the other notorious thing about microwaves is the waves aren't equal, so they don't equally distribute to the food. It burned a part of it, and it literally caught on fire. And I got videos of onion on fire, and they said it could smell out for weeks. So I did have to put a caveat on the site going, okay, just make sure you check your microwave is not doing
See,
anything
this
crazy.
This is good. We're busting myths about your technique.
I feel like onions are one of those things that are constantly being talked about. I mean, at least between my mom and my aunt, I'm letting you know how crazily bad my family's cooking is. Like cutting onions is something that we always had a lot of myths about or life hacks about. Like, do you freeze the onion for 20 minutes before you cook it? Do you put oil on the knife before you cut it? Like all the ways that you won't cry when you eat onions. What's your technique?
So to not cry, I use one of these, and it's a little fan, and essentially it's just aerosolized sulfur compounds that are coming off of the onion. And so if you do microwave it, you can get that off faster, but it's still going to be there. And when you look at commercial production, people wear goggles because of that aerosolization. And so what I do is I just have this little fan, and I just put it right above the onion, and it just sweeps all that away, and that works for me.
Oh, so you get your family. You get them to cry.
You get everybody else.
You're like, get it out of my face. But I don't care who else's face it goes to.
Secondhand onion. Yes, that's what we're going for.
How do you keep avocado from turning brown? This is, I love your techniques.
Yeah, so What's happening with avocados is polyphenol acetate, I believe is the word, but there's a very specific enzyme that browns avocado faster. You can find it in apples. Apples do the same thing. Lettuce does the same thing. So do mushrooms. But essentially what you're trying to do is prevent oxygen from getting to it. And you can either do one of two things, prevent that oxygen, or you can denature that enzyme. And so the technique that I show with guacamole, because it's relevant to the actual food, is I put lemon juice or lime juice over the surface, and that denatures the enzyme. Now, you need a lot of it to actually get a good coverage. The second piece is oxygen. There's a lot of myths out there around using the pit. Somebody also said you should put the peel, and I've heard all sorts of wacky stuff. They generally don't work. You need to stop the oxygen or denature the enzyme. And so to stop, to denature the lime juice, to stop the oxygen, get cling wrap and put it, press it right against the surface. You can also do that to fresh avocado. So if you cut it in half and you decide not to use the rest, just seal it real tight with cling wrap. So that's what I use.
So pit, keeping the pit busted. I've also heard store with onion in the same container. I've also heard this one, which I find really gross, is you just turn it upside down in water, which gets rid of the oxygen, but then like it gets kind of gross pretty fast. Like
you
have to be
gooey.
Using it by the end of the day. Otherwise it's just, it's not good. But like the onion one, God, I've heard that one forever. And it feels like it kind of works. And I don't know why.
I haven't tested that. I'm just not seeing how much sulfur it can release to actually stop the polyphenol acetate.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like you would need a lot of onion, even if that were true. I'll have to test that later today. So I'll report back.
Okay, add that to your list. I personally have like a little silicone rub, like it looks like an avocado that you slap right on top of the avocado, like a little lid, and it's silicone because I despise cling wrap.
A lot of plastic.
Yeah. Which we were just talking about this, that there are some studies coming out of South Korea that there's a possibility that kimchi might be able to help flush microplastics. They've only tested it in mice. It just suggests it. But like more studies on that. And just in case, I'm going to eat a bunch of kimchi.
I feel like it seems right. You know, like, well, first, I subscribe to the fact that kimchi solves all your problems. I ate a lot of kimchi growing up.
Oh, yeah.
But if it were true, that would be amazing. I heard that one, and then I heard stuff about some, like, kombucha maybe having some benefits, but I think we still have to learn. Because the idea of PFAS and all those compounds is it just sticks to your cells. So I'm not exactly sure how that would work, but... I mean, I eat a lot of kimchi, so I mean, knock on wood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was saying that like it clings to it and takes it out with it.
You know, one of my dreams actually, so I haven't shared this broadly yet, but I'm moving to Sacramento. One of my dreams is like when we get a little more space to actually have like a bigger lab where we can start testing things for microplastics and trying to really understand what's good, what's bad and all that stuff. So one day I'll be able to do a proper deep dive.
Well, that's California. You call us. We'll come up there and maybe we can help out with one of your experiments.
Okay. Here's a myth that I'm curious to know about. Should you wash your chicken?
Oh boy. So... the answer is no. You shouldn't wash your chicken. You should wipe it. And there's a lot of reasons for it. And it really comes down to food safety. The thing with the bacteria and all the germs that you get on chicken is they're very easily, I don't want to say aerosolized, but they can spread very quickly. And so in a commercial space, we typically say, don't run raw chicken underwater. Definitely don't use soap. You can, there's culturally, I believe there's some cultures that use, you know,
wait,
little vinegar.
Did you say use soap? People use soap?
Yeah, who uses soap? Who does it? Nobody does that. What?
If you go far enough in a rabbit hole on TikTok, you'll start seeing those.
That's really far. Like, that's insane.
It's wild. But there is a misconception that... you have to wipe it off before you clean it and all that. And some cultures still use highly acidic stuff, but it doesn't really do much. Just cook it to temp, pasteurize your chicken. That's the easiest way to go.
What is like the weirdest, most surprising thing you've ever, like that you're constantly learning about cooking? So what's the most surprising thing that you've learned?
Well, technique wise, there's still so much that I'm still, learning. One thing I'm trying to become better at is wok cooking. I know, like, that was actually how I spent most of my, professional cooking career, if you will, is cooking on a wok. But it's so technique based that you get a very small window to make the food right perfectly. And so you need kind of the right burner, you need the right skills, everything has to hit the pan the right way. And so I'm always like working on it. That would, I say, technique wise, requires the most like flick of the wrist, if you will, as I like to say. The thing that I'm still trying to learn more about is herbs and nutrition. So I feel like we as society still don't really understand how like herbal medicine works or how all those herbs interact. Like, for example, I learned the other day, a couple months ago, that nutmeg, if you have 2 tablespoons, becomes a hallucinogen and it's highly toxic.
Wait, what? Okay, for that'd be aggressive.
Oh, I'm gonna try tablespoons that one. Let's test that myth
nutmeg.
Out.
Nutmeg. Tori and I tried the cinnamon challenge where you put it in your, how much was it, Tori? Was it a tablespoon? And then you have to like.
Yeah, it was a tablespoon, like, but I like this, where this is going to. Is this true or is this just like.
You have to try it.
I think it might be worth an experiment, but maybe under good supervision.
Tori, I feel
how
like
much
we might have a.
You have to
that's
do?
Like a Tide Pod. 2 tablespoons.
It's going to be
two
so much cheaper than mushrooms.
I feel like the expense is really the. Do you remember putting the cinnamon in your mouth for that long a period of time? It would like we were getting sick off of it. I coughed it all up. You were the one that lasted the longest, and it was horrifying. Like your nose was watering. It was bad. Like, I feel like that. I don't think you're going to enjoy 2 tablespoons of nutmeg.
So wait, where did you hear this study about the nutmeg? This is fascinating to me.
This science?
So there's a specific compound, I can't remember the name of it, I think it starts with M, that apparently triggers that. And so nutmeg toxicity apparently is an issue. There's apparently some history behind it. I'm still trying to find a connection, but nutmeg used to be very expensive back in the day because they believed that it cured the plague. So plague doctors, if you know, like they have that big mask with the they used to put that in the tip of their nose or whatever because they believed that it actually did something. I don't know if they're connected. I feel like they're somehow interrelated. But I think from what I understand, that's where they started learning more about that compound and how bad it is for you, so on and so forth. And there was apparently an episode a while back where teenagers were taking that as a hallucinogen. I need to do more research before I try it out for myself.
They're licking frogs. They're taking nutmeg. Okay, say nutmeg contains mithricin. Mithricin, mithricin, which produces a potent delirant type hallucinations when consumed in large doses. Typically takes 1 to 7 hours for effects to begin and can cause severe symptoms, including delirium, extreme anxiety, rapid heart rate, and it lasts for days. Because this is severe prolonged hangover and the physical distress.
If you're listening.
Medical professionals strongly advise against consuming it for recreational purposes.
Wow. That's wild. Oh, my God. You know, I do love your technique of keeping herbs. You have this great video about, like, green onions, parsley, like, keeping your herbs fresh in the fridge. Can you break those down for our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. So herbs are really interesting. They're live plants. And so the question comes down to how well or for how long can you keep that going or sustain that life? And there's really 2 groups of herbs and plants that I focus on in that video, and they're soft stem and hard stem. So hard stems, you know, quite literally speaking, they have like a woody branch. So like a thyme, rosemary are great examples. They typically don't last very long. They just need moisture on the leaf. And so you want to basically wrap them in a damp towel to let it just absorb as much moisture as it can. There are soft stem plants like basil is a great example. And then there's other types of herbs like green onion where because they still have a very healthy stem, they can still absorb water from the bottom. And so for those types, you want to put it in water and put it in a fridge to just slow down that metabolism, if you will, for the lack of a better term. And that will keep those herbs fresh for, you know, up to 4 weeks. And I came up with that because, you know, I think herbs are getting really expensive. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was the number one feedback that I got from my viewers. I think it got like 30 million views and a ton of people said like, this is going to save me so much money.
Yeah.
But it's such a great tip for anybody, really.
Because you throw them away when they start getting soggy. And
yeah,
then it's just
so annoying. It's like you buy it and then like days later, it's like either turning yellow or it's wilting and you're just like, great.
Yeah, I have a bunch of parsley in my fridge right now that's been there for 2.5 months and it's still fresh.
Really?
Wow. You have to change out the water?
I change out the water about every week or so. And it's a little plastic Cambro, something like this. You can use a cup, but very simple. Yeah. Just like yay bit of water just to let it absorb. But my fridge is also a little on the colder side, but it can last a while if you take good care of it.
With basil, don't you have to cover it with something? Because I feel like if I just put basil in water, it wilts.
Yes. So basil is an exception. So basil is a tropical plant. And so if you put it in fridge, it'll actually blister. So the cells mm-hmm. will actually struggle in that cold temperature. So you have to keep that in room temp. So basil, what I typically recommend, get a small glass and put it on your windowsill just so it still gets that sun, get some oxygen flowing. But they usually don't last very long. So just get a basil plant. Do your
That's
best
what
with
I
it.
Do. Yeah, I've got so many herbs. I'm turning into a plant hoarder because I love having all the herbs and microgreens growing in my windowsill just so I don't have to go buy new ones.
It's so much easier.
I end up throwing them out all the time.
So I'm hoping that I'm going to do more videos on this. I created a little page that has, I think, 50 vegetables. So like another fun example is if you have carrot that peeled, mm-hmm. Don't just like throw it in your fridge like most people do. Put it in a jar full of water and it'll stay crispy for like a month. And so those are these neat little tricks that I want to share more with people just so they can save a little extra money.
That one I do know. My mom had that for sure. Yeah. That she could do that.
All right. So I have some steak myths for you. Searing steak will lock in the juices. Letting the steak rest after it's cooked. And like, how many times should you flip a steak? Like, do you just set it and leave it and then flip it? Or are you doing it every minute? I'm just curious what your take is on the science behind cooking a good steak.
I feel like you're settling some sort of like a contest, like maybe with your dad or a bar myth or something.
No, it's just, you hear everybody saying like, oh, you have to let the steak rest. And I'm just curious, you having a science background, if you've ever done any experiments to see, is there a difference, you know, to let it rest or not? Does the searing actually lock in the juices?
Yeah. So resting absolutely makes a difference. So when you cook a steak and it's still really hot and you cut into it, because there's so much temperature or heat energy in those steaks still, it'll start to evaporate all the moisture that's in the steak. And so if you have like a really nice cut that's nicely marbled, what actually happens is there's a lot of collagen that essentially melts into gelatin throughout the cooking process. If you let that rest, that gelatin will actually sort of seal around the muscle fibers and capture that moisture, making it extra juicy. And so you definitely want to rest. I think the other one was around flipping. I don't know that flipping makes any difference. So you probably just ignore that one. You can keep it there. You can flip it. That's totally up to you. I'm just really lazy, so I just leave it until it's done. The thing that I think, though, that most people forget is that the surface has to be dry. And so there's a concept around dry brining, where you essentially brine a steak by, you know, putting salt on it, pulls out the moisture, and then you let it suck back in and the surface remains dry in the fridge. That is probably the most important because that helps you form the crust. And other than that, it's pretty straightforward. I will say the one most common mistake that people make is they believe that a darker steak is better or that the pan has to be searing hot. There's a concept called pyrolysis, where after the meat hits over 500 degrees Fahrenheit, it just burns. So they've actually done some tests on this, and I've done this a little bit myself. If you have a perfectly looking, picture-perfect steak with like grill marks, and it's like nice and black on the surface, if you do a blind test, that actually tastes worse than a steak that's a little bit, maybe slightly gray or slightly brown, but just like perfectly brown, not so black. So you want to keep it around the 350 to 400 range. Don't put it in a searing hot pan. I know I'm going to get a lot of comments for this, or you guys
yes.
will get a lot of comments.
Very controversial.
Yeah, totally. No, this is great.
I feel like every commercial I've seen, they've got those black lines on the meat.
Mm-hmm. It looks mm-hmm. good, but doesn't really taste that much better. There okay. is another one. Yeah,
but no, wait, just real quick, your explanation of why you should let the steak rest, that's the best explanation I've ever heard. Like, it makes so much sense. It's how you just described that. It's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I'll let it rest now.
Maybe they weren't talking about your steak, Tori. They're just like, come on, Tori, let it rest. Come on.
There's another area where you want to let it rest, which is brisket. So brisket is one of those cuts, a smoked brisket, where you want to let it rest for a very long time for that gelatin to settle in. There's another fun myth that I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for, is that, you know, with brisket, they talk about smoke rings, that pink smoke ring on the outside. Mm-hmm. They always say like, oh, you need that smoke ring for it to taste good. That's actually not a result of good smoking. It's a result of nitrous oxide or nitric oxide that's reacting with that with the meat. So you can get that also with curing salt. That's what they do to keep that meat pink. Now, it is indicative of good wood that is smoking it. But even if you don't have that pink ring, it'll still taste smoky and good, which is why a lot of barbecue competitions got rid of that requirement. But there's another myth that I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for.
I love your controversial takes. So for our viewers at home, for our Mythfits at home, what's the biggest mistake that most home cooks make?
The biggest mistake that home cooks make, I would say one thing that people overlook the most is pan temperature. So when we talk a lot about pan frying and you see recipes, it'll say low, medium, or high heat. But low, medium, and high actually changes based on the stovetop. So it's actually a very poor way of seeing how hot a surface is.
Yeah.
I always recommend home cooks to get, if you're going to get any sort of fancy cooking equipment, it's going to be a probe thermometer, something like this, with a little like pokey on it, and a laser thermometer. So you actually know how hot a surface is. A lot of people cook things too hot and too fast. So I did a video on salmon where I talk about cold searing, and I say, put the skin of the salmon on the pan on low heat, but people don't really understand what low heat means. So I have to give a very specific temperature, 200 degrees. So those are some things that I think a lot of people could use some help on in the kitchen.
Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. All right, Chef, where can everybody find you? Give us your handles, your socials. Where can the Mythfits go find Chef Fatty?
Chef Fatty, you can search on any platform and I'll pop up, but the handle is It's Chef Fatty.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for coming in and doing some little myth busting with us.
No, I appreciate it. It's an honor. Again, I'm still starstruck. It's so nice to see you both.
Man, that guy is so interesting. Like his techniques, it's like he is not just telling you because he thinks this is what's going on. He knows exactly what's going on. And, it's just, I love watching his reels. Like everything he does, it's just like so interesting.
Yeah, it's that perfect combination of science and food where you just, you know, because it cooking really is, it's so much practice to get it just right. And to be able to understand why things are happening is so helpful. I mean, I saw him for the first time when I was trying to cook chicken and I'm so bad at it.
We forgot to show him the video of your 4th of July barbecue.
Tori.
Can we show that now?
That's not Carrie real. That is
Carrie Byron
is
on the fake, grill. Can we take a look at that real quick?
Fake news, Tori Belachy. That is
see
fake
Carrie's
news.
Technique of grilling hamburgers. What do you call that technique? Incinerate?
That wasn't me. That's not real. You're trying to give me a bad reputation already.
Well, that was fun. I'm so glad you found him, and he seems like a great guy, and I look forward to going to his pop-up. I hope he has a pop-up restaurant, because that would be amazing. I think I'm going to hire him to come cater. Like that, his food looks so good.
Okay, Tori, it is that time. Are you ready for a fan question? I believe we have one that's actually from the band of Mythfits. If you guys want to go to mythfitspodcast.com, you can submit your questions, and we will answer them live on the air at the end of these episodes. This one here comes from Jim Mishler. Why didn't you use Buster to test the airplane brace position myth? I've always wondered about that. In case you guys don't remember, the airplane brace position myth is that the it's a lot cheaper to pay out a wrongful death than an injury claim. So the airlines put you in the brace position, and the conspiracy is so it'll break your neck and you will die.
Kill you outright. Then
dark.
Then years of recovery.
Yes, dark. Yeah. So we made ourselves a rig. We used some airplane seats. It went slightly wrong because the airplane seats were rigid, and we we all got very hurt on that experiment.
Dang, I think we did need a That's a good question, man.
We needed Jim, a neck brace after that.
We should have used Buster. We were thinking idiots. But that's a good question. Why did we jump in there before testing it on Buster?
Well, you can't break Buster's neck. It was made of... it didn't have like a... like a bone to it. It was just like it was a hinge. So you couldn't really break it.
I think we felt like it was a safe enough experiment, but it turned out to be way more dangerous than we thought. We got way more hurt than we were prepared for.
We could have put didn't we use like lamb for the same kind of neck bone?
Yeah.
For a
we
human.
Could have we made could have a breakable made a lamb neck.
Yeah, that would have made sense.
We could have used a breakable neck instead of using our own necks. Wow.
That was Look early days, Tori.
Putting
that
our
was
necks
early days.
On the line for science.
Well, thank you guys. Thank you for that question, Jim. Thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed our episode with Chef Batty.
Yeah, thanks for coming back and hanging out with us.
Stay curious, stay weird, and come back next Monday.
Pioneer.